Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Stephen Zunis. Stephen Zunis is an associate professor of politics and chair of the Peace and Justice Studies program at the University of San Francisco. He also serves as a senior policy analyst and Middle East editor for the Foreign Policy in Focus Project and as a research associate at the Center for Global, International, and Regional Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He lives in Santa Cruz. He's got just long lists of studies and things that he's involved in here. Let's see, you were also, Stephen Zunis, a recipient of the National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship on Middle Eastern and Central Asian Studies at Dartmouth College, and on and on. So your specialty is the Middle East. I know that. And you're very busy these days talking about it. And peace and justice is what we need. So I want to welcome you. I know that you're very concerned about what's going on right now, as I am. So where do we start here? We are talking about attacking Iraq any day, the United States attacking Iraq.
Well, there's certainly some very important humanitarian and legal questions regarding a U.S. invasion of Iraq. But one thing that's often overlooked is how, like our policy in the Middle East in general in recent decades, it will not help the security interests of the United States, but in fact make things worse. In my recently published book, Tenderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism.
I'm sorry, I didn't mention that. Let me say it again. Tenderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism is just Stephen Zunis' most recent book, and you can get that all around, and it's a very nice book.
Thank you. I basically emphasize that the more the United States has militarized the Middle East, the less and less secure it's become, that it has created its own reaction by increasing anti-American resentment in that part of the world. And indeed, an invasion of Iraq, I believe, would fall right into Osama bin Laden's hands. I mean, if there is any method to the madness of September 11, 2001, it was to hope the United States would overreact in such a way that would increase the already strong anti-American resentment over there. As most Muslims will tell you, bin Laden doesn't know much about Islam, but he is a businessman by profession, and like any good businessman, he knows how to take perceived desires or grievances of the consumers and translate it into a desire for his product. His product is anti-American terrorism.
I'm just going to interrupt you because I have to say that I don't agree with your basic premise about Osama bin, about this all being Osama bin Laden's fault, and Osama bin Laden and the Bush family and the bin Laden family have been very involved. I just have to make that statement. We're not going to go into that in this program because there's a million reasons to be very, very concerned about what's going on. It's very scary and dangerous, and so I'm not going to go off on that, but I just have to be out front about my opinion is different than yours about that.
But in any case, the fact is that American policy in the Middle East has not made the United States more secure, but less secure. Every intervention we've had has ended up blowing up in the faces of America sooner or later. The overthrow of the constitutional government of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953 and bringing in the Shah as the absolute dictator, who wiped out the democratic and progressive opposition, led to the rise of the hardline Islamists, who ended up seizing power in the Islamic Revolution in 1979. It was the U.S. decision to back the most extremist of the anti-Soviet Mujahideen in Afghanistan, the Hekmatyar faction, which led to the chaos and resulted in the rise of the Taliban. It was the U.S. Bombing of Libyan cities in 1986, which led to the Lockerbie bombing, and the U.S. intervention in Lebanon, of course, created all sorts of serious problems for the United States, and that resulted in an upsurge of American anti-American terrorism and Islamic radicalism in that country. I could go on.
But yeah, the main point is, I guess, and I'm sure you're going to say this, and I forgot to mention that you'd written a rebuttal that I read to Bush's State of the Union speech, which I thought was very good, because a lot of people think the United States is doing good things with their tax money, but in fact, as you can explain much better than I, they're actually creating a lot of the problems.
Very much so. And again, that's a big theme of Tinderbach. It is something that even people of a more conservative persuasion could read and learn from, because I look at these utilitarian arguments that and I fear that an invasion of Iraq, of course, will just make things worse. We've been told in the United States that we're hated because of our freedom and democracy, but the reality, of course, is our policy in the Middle East has had little to do with freedom and democracy. It's been about supporting autocratic regimes and occupation armies. And given that the United States, to my knowledge, has never really supported democracy in the Arab world, the idea that an invasion of Iraq is in part to give the Iraqis the right to choose their own leadership seems pretty facile, given the history of the United States in that part of the world. Similarly, claims that we need to do this to support UN Security Council resolutions. I mean, there are over 100 UN Security Council resolutions currently being violated, and at most a dozen by Iraq. But there are other Middle Eastern countries that are violating even more UN Security Council resolutions than that, including U.S. allies like Morocco, Israel, and Turkey. And if we have not threatened to invade these countries, we have actively given these countries the economic, military, and diplomatic support that makes it possible for them to defy these UN Security Council resolutions. I don't think we're particularly interested in weapons of mass destruction either. Not only do we support already existing nuclear powers like Israel and Pakistan in the region, and we want to impose this kind of nuclear apartheid. You know, we can. You know, some countries we like can have nuclear weapons, and countries we don't cannot. But it ignores the fact that when Iraq had a nuclear program that was well on its way to creating a bomb, when it had a large chemical arsenal, a large biological weapons arsenal, it had hundreds of ballistic missiles. Back in the 1980s, in other words, when they really were a threat in terms of their weapons of mass destruction, the United States was supporting the regime. And now, according to UNSCOM, 817 of their 819 ballistic missiles, Scud missiles, have been accounted for and destroyed. They may have a dozen or so of the homemade variety, but there's some questions whether their launchers even work. The International Atomic Energy Agency says their nuclear program has been completely dismantled. Scott Ritter, the head inspector there, has said that 95% of the chemical weapons have been accounted for destroyed. Biological weapons are the big question mark, but you need certain kinds of delivery systems. There's a little question a serious question whether Iraq even has that capability. So, you know, they're only a fraction, only a shell of their once formidable military prowess. So it seems rather odd that now all of a sudden they're considered this big threat. What I see this really being about, quite frankly, is a kind of imposition of American hegemony, a Pax Americana, a kind of new imperium. And this is not just a conspiracy of the left or Arab nationalists or Islamist radicals. You just need to read some of the articles written by many of the neoconservative architects of this policy. Look at the reports of various think tanks, which the Bush administration is associated with, and even the planning documents by the United States for its defense strategy in the region for the coming years. They basically come out and say this. This is a new era where the United States is more powerful than any combination of countries in the world, and we can reshape things in our new image. And if the United States can control Iraq, not only would the United States be in control of a country with the second largest oil reserves in the world, but we'd be able to set up permanent military bases. We don't have to worry about the xenophobic Saudis anymore. and we'd be in charge of this country that borders Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Turkey, important countries that would have a lot of leverage over them as a result. And there's a certain strategic logic to it, but it's a 19th century logic. This is Hobbesian. This is literally a reactionary foreign policy that undercuts the most basic premises of the international legal system that have been built up in the past century, ironically under the leadership of such American presidents as Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, it's pretty nasty just to go killing people to rule the world. I mean, it doesn't fit with my values, I'll tell you that, and apparently not with a lot of other people's values who are standing up in the United States and all over the world and saying, we don't want this. But it also seems like there's a lot of people who don't understand. Of course, there's always, I always come back to this question of the media and how things get presented and people's kind of confidence in, well, the president, never mind that he wasn't even elected, you know, must be doing the right thing and the way that fear is fed. And I'm sure you'd like to comment on this, Stephen Zunis.
It's very much fear-mongering and, you know, taking advantage of the both the widespread racism in this country towards Arabs and Muslims, but even more so, I think, as a direct result of the tragedy of 9/11, that there is, because the architects of these policies, people like Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, and the like, these folks were around during the Reagan administration. They were advocating an outright U.S. invasion of Nicaragua, a U.S. invasion of Cuba, even a first strike, so-called limited nuclear war against the Soviet Union. And even the Reagan people thought these people were kind of nutty. And yet now they are front and center. They are the mainstream of U.S. foreign policy. And they could only get that way, I believe, because they were able to take advantage of the fear and anger and sense of nationalism that has resulted in the United States as a result of 9/11. But I think it's important to emphasize, again, in addition to the very important humanitarian and legal arguments, is that it will really hurt American security. I'm very frightened about the what would result from the bombing of Baghdad, a city of 5 million people, and U.S. infantry trying to march into the city, and the damage it will do, and both, of course, because of humanitarian grounds. But what is it going? But one thing that you have in the Islamic world you didn't have 12 years ago during the first Gulf War is satellite television, which will be showing in graphic color around the Islamic world the deaths of thousands of civilians at the hands of this bombardment. And is that going to make America safer? I don't think so.
And Americans sometimes, if they don't think, and I think people in Europe and other parts of the world who've experienced war more directly are a lot smarter about this, and that's probably why they're standing up quicker and so strongly. A lot of Americans think there's nobody in Iraq but one person, Saddam Hussein, and it's, you know, because it's not televised and because we haven't experienced this kind of thing, they just don't get it, it seems like. And, of course, using nuclear weapons and all these kinds of things, it certainly hurts the people who go there, the people, the military from this country who are there. And this stuff doesn't stay in one place. I mean, and people just, they're so uninformed. It's like they just don't get it. It's not only uninformed, I guess. It's more deep than that, the denial.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think it's easy to demonize you know, people like Saddam Hussein. And while I... Well, I think the threat from Iraq is greatly exaggerated. I don't think there's any question about the nature of the regime. It's a very, very nasty regime.
But there's nasty regimes all over the place.
Yeah, there certainly are, and the United States supports many of them. But you know, and more crucially, all these years we've been saying, oh, we'll do this to Saddam, we've done that to Saddam, and you know, Saddam and his henchmen are safe in their bunkers and getting plenty of food and medical care, while the vast majority of ordinary Iraqis has already suffered enough under his rule. Are the ones who
and under our bombing.
Yes, and are doing the dying, and that's again one of the real tragedies. And that's why I think there's I think U.S. officials are sadly mistaken that the Iraqis will welcome with open arms U.S. forces marching into the country, because I think while the vast majority of Iraqis would love to be freed of Saddam Hussein. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to welcome this Western army that's been bombing them and starving them and doing all this stuff to them for the past dozen years or so. In fact, and helped propped up the Saddam regime in its crucial early days. I believe it could be a pretty nasty situation because, you know, it's one thing to fight in flat, open desert like the first Gulf War, where the United States could take advantage of its firepower and superior technology. But urban warfare is nasty no matter how many smart bombs you get. We could have hundreds of Black Hawk Down type scenarios. And the other issue is this, of course, is that while I've never bought into this thing that Saddam Hussein would use weapons of mass destruction as a first strike. I mean, the guy's evil, but he's not suicidal. And I think deterrence, it works. It would work with him just as it did with Stalin or Mao or any dictator, especially, and they were much more powerful than the United States, much more powerful than Saddam Hussein ever was. But So I think, you know, deterrence certainly applies here, but what if he has nothing to lose? And what if this logic of self-preservation is no longer in effect, as when U.S. troops are advancing on Baghdad? Then whatever small amounts of chemical and biological weapons he may still have squirreled away, he could very well utilize. It would be against American forces, and what would the response be? There's already been open talk of the United States using tactical nuclear weapons, and so there's some really scary scenarios right now that could come out of an invasion. I mean, perhaps there'll be some miracle. There'll be a coup or something. But it's a huge, huge risk, especially given the fact that Iraq really is not the kind of threat or risk it was back 12, 15 years ago when the United States was supporting it.
Well, Stephen Zunis, I want to remind people that your latest book is called Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. And I'd like to talk about Israel, the Israeli-Palestinian issue, or like for you to talk about it, because I have my view about that too. But I've heard people say that this issue is so central to what's going on in the Middle East, and it never really gets addressed the way it should. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if the Bush policy is different than ever before. You just said, of course, Israel has nuclear bombs, and we don't, you know, we support them. How much money do we give to Israel every day? We give more than to any other country, I think, right?
Yeah, certainly. Israel's only about 1/1000th of the world's population, but it gets more than a third of all U.S. foreign aid, depending on how you calculate it, up to $4 billion annually. And that, you know, makes possible the occupation and repression and colonization of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The United States has been the major supporter of Israel since the 1967 war, which is interesting because, you know, back in the Israel's first 20 years, when its democratic institutions were strongest and it was most vulnerable strategically, the United States hardly gave any assistance. It's only after they found themselves more powerful than any combination of Arab armies and the occupier of a large Arab civilian population that U.S. Aid started to grow. And in fact, in my book, I point out the fact that the stronger and more repressive Israel has become, the more and more U.S. aid has poured in. So it's not like we're trying to support the struggling democracy against the Arab hordes or anything like that. Rather, we see Israel as an important strategic ally. Because when you think about what Israel's done for the United States, they provide battlefield testing for American equipment. They have crushed radical nationalist movements, not just among the Palestinians, but in Jordan and Lebanon as well. They have supported pro-American regimes and insurgencies in various parts of the world. In fact, they've even funneled U.S. arms to third countries. The United States could not give arms to directly for political reasons, like apartheid South Africa, the Contras, the Guatemalan junta, the mullahs in Iran. The military-industrial complexes of the two countries are very closely intertwined. The Mossad and CIA collaborate in intelligence gathering, covert operations. So there's a very close strategic relationship. And in fact, it's somewhat ironic because in many ways it parallels the way going back, all the way back to medieval Europe, where Jews were kind of set up to be the moneylenders and tax collectors, you know, kind of the visible agents of the oppressive order, so that – that the Jews become the easy scapegoat when the real power behind it kind of gets away. So we have these reactionary Arab states, you know, blaming Israel, Zionism, the Jews for their problems. So the real power. In fact, I've talked to at least a half dozen Arab foreign ministers and deputy foreign ministers, and then when I ask them about why are you still so friendly to the United States, given our policy towards the Palestinians and Iraq and everything like that, they've all said, oh, your ambassador or your State Department guy explained it's because the Jews really run U.S. foreign policy. Well, how convenient. I mean, this is sort of the classic scapegoating thing. It's not, and I'm not saying that the pro-Israel lobby doesn't have influence. It does. But it's exaggerated, I think, quite deliberately to get the real power brokers off the hook. Because, after all, the United States supported Indonesia's occupation of East Timor for 24 years, which was even more brutal than Israel's occupation of the West Bank. And we didn't have an Indonesian-American lobby. And the United States continues to support Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara. We don't have a Moroccan-American lobby. Or Turkey's occupation of Northern Cyprus. It's not a Turkish-American lobby. Our government, unfortunately, is quite capable of supporting right-wing regimes that invade, occupy, colonize, and suppress small neighboring states without an ethnic lobby to make it possible. It's part of the much broader strategic design that the United States has in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm really hoping you're giving a lot of information here, Stephen Zunis, and for people that aren't already somewhat informed, and who we don't know who the listeners are, so probably some of them are, you know, real informed and some aren't. But I think for me, the main point is that the United States, when they present themselves through the media, the government presents itself through the media as this concerned nation that only supports democracy and wants to get rid of this horrible dictator that gassed its own people. And you point out in your book that the same, or somewhere that I read, that at the same time that Saddam Hussein was gassing Kurds or really being brutal to Kurds in his country, we were supporting the same thing in Turkey right next door. So, I mean, there's all these double standards and all these lies that are really hard for the average person to disentangle or even realize that they're lies.
It's even worse than that in the sense that not only did the United States supply many of the chemicals for the chemical weapons, you know, through U.S. taxpayer-funded agricultural subsidies, supposedly for pesticides that were being diverted to the chemical weapons program. But the seed stock for their anthrax came from the United States. And indeed, most of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs did come from Western industrialized countries, including the United States. But remember, Iraq's been under a strict embargo for the past 13 years or so, and so they have not been able to get this kind of stuff anymore. So the idea they can somehow rebuild it from scratch without the technology and raw materials from the West is unrealistic. Even worse, in terms of this chemical weapons thing, is that the we now know from reports from the Washington Post, New York Times, and elsewhere that the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency actually had people on the ground in Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war using American satellite footage to help the Iraqis target Iranian troop concentrations in the full knowledge they were using chemical weapons. And similarly, when Saddam Hussein attacked Halabja and Kurdish civilian areas with chemical weapons in 1988, the United States covered up for the fact by falsely claiming it was the Iranians who did it. And so when they say, oh, he used chemical weapons of mass destruction, he might use them again. Well, first of all, the United States used weapons of mass destruction against Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But even putting that aside, that Saddam Hussein's basically a coward. I mean, he'll use weapons of mass destruction when he knows he can get away with it. But certainly now he recognizes that would be the end of him. So again, he's evil as all get out, but he's not suicidal. This new doctrine the United States has that, well, he might be developing weapons that he might someday use against us as grounds for an invasion. I mean, can you imagine if every country in the world used that as a rationale for invading another country? I mean, we'd have countries invading each other all over the place. It would lead to the whole breakdown of the whole international order.
Well, it's kind of like the Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act, when you can be brought in with no trial, no lawyer, no charges for maybe you know somebody who maybe might know somebody who has a cousin who might possibly be a suspected terrorist. It's kind of the same kind of reasoning, and it's quite seriously awful.
What's also interesting, of course, is that Iraq's support for international terrorism peaked in the 1980s, and the United States dropped him from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism, because if you're on that list, you can't get the technology and weapons you want to send to Saddam Hussein. And now, according to the State Department, the CIA, FBI, Saddam's support for international terrorism has dropped to virtually nothing, and certainly no evidence of ties to al-Qaeda. Remember, al-Qaeda is a radical Islamist group, whereas Saddam's regime is decidedly secular. And Saddam is called, bin Laden is called Saddam an apostate, an infidel, a traitor to Islam, all that kind of stuff. This linkage, and especially the accusation by Powell and others, have been looked into by independent media and most terrorism experts. It simply doesn't hold any water. So it's really almost every rationale for Iraqi invasion just doesn't hold up under closer scrutiny, and it's just really frightening that the United States has the power to convince the American, at least a large segment of the American public, and certainly Congress and the mainstream media, and a surprisingly large segment of some public opinion overseas, or at least some of the governments, is disconcerting. But I'm heartened by the fact that there is a growing anti-war movement in the United States. I am heartened that in Europe, the Middle East, and around the world, we're seeing more and more people speaking out and saying, "No, this is wrong. This is crazy. This isn't right," and that is really what gives me hope.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we're right now. We should let people know what is it. It's like the 12th or something of February. I think that's it, the 12th of February. I like to date things now. Things are moving so fast that it's really important to know when interviews have happened. So we're going to be having some more demonstrations this weekend, and that's really good. It really is very, very heartening. So Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, that is the latest book by Stephen Zunis. And do you want to give any contact information?
Sure. It's published in the United States by Common Courage Press. Zed Press, based in England, is circulating it through much of the rest of the world. Parangon in France has translated it into French. There are also Italian and Greek translations in progress. So the book is definitely making the rounds. I would also encourage people to check out the Foreign Policy in Focus website, www.fpif.org. Again, that's www.fpif.org, which has a collection of some very timely and analysis and critiques of U.S. foreign policy, not just in the Middle East, but elsewhere around the world, issues ranging from human rights to globalization to the so-called war on terrorism. Also a good resource both to get some of my own writings, I'm the Middle East editor there, but from some other outstanding voices, both in the United States and around the world.
Okay. Well, I want to let you know Zunis is spelled Z-U-N-E-S. So I want to thank you very much, Stephen Zunis.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. To order a copy of the program you just heard, write down the following information. The email is sue@suesupriano.com. That's Sue, S-U-E, at Sue Supriano, SUESUPRIANO.com. Or the telephone is 510-883-1979. That's 510-883-1979.